companies legal, their actions lawful, whether or not they are just doing that for the Israeli government or whether they are exporting abroad. It is very clear that the production of weapons that is meant for the commission of international crimes is a crime in itself and by itself. The export of those weapons, those three companies that we are naming, are big exporter. They, I was at the NATO summit a couple of months ago. I mean, the fact that we need to understand that for decades, our defense, our Western defense community, the surveillance community, the IT community has been completely embedded with the Israeli companies. It was very clear at the NATO summit. So those companies are major actors globally. We therefore have the tools, and that's where Netanyahu got afraid, because we do have the tools not only not to export to Israel, which we must do, but we have also the tool to sanction those companies, Israeli companies. This is what we call for. We demand that state and other companies stop purchasing from Erbil and the others. We demand that they divest from those companies. We demand that they are barred from attending anything related to our market. That's because the power of sanction is indeed very, very important. And we the people must make sure that our governments deliver on their obligations.
Well, I mean, there's also the question, which you highlight in the report, of the political, extraordinary political support that has enabled this, as you say, genocide to continue for now almost 2 years. You're here for the 18th session of the UN General Assembly. Mm-hmm. Now, Netanyahu announced earlier this week that he's coming again to the White House for the fourth time, as the U.S. simultaneously earlier this month announced that they're suspending visas for Palestinian passport holders, including the Palestinian officials who were expected to attend the UN General Assembly session.
So first and foremost, let's highlight the fact that the United States is holding all of us hostage of the fact that the General Assembly is taking place in New York. And that, frankly, should be unacceptable to the UN and to all member states of the UN. The U.S. political support to Israel for many years, but particularly for the last 24 months, is what has sustained the genocide. There are other support. Germany is one of them. The EU as an institution, until very recently, that is last week or 2 weeks ago, has failed to take action against Israel. The political support has been there all along. Let's not, however, suggest that behind the good denunciation of some governments, including in the Arab world, there were actions. No. There were no actions. And this is what we are insisting upon. You know, you can denounce as much as you want. If you do not take actions, including economic actions, then your words are empty.
Agnes Callamard, you are here in New York for this 80th session of the UN General Assembly. The theme is Better Together, 80 years and more for peace, development, and human rights. This at the same time that the world is watching this live-streamed assault on an entire population in Gaza. The brutal footage on their phones every day might think the UN is totally useless. What are your thoughts on this and your recommendations for reform of the UN? You even mentioned people are talking about moving the UN out if they're going to impose who can come to the UN, the countries they like, and who cannot come. Why should it even be in New York? But the rules themselves.
Yeah. Look, Amnesty has made a number of recommendations regarding the multilateral system and the UN in particular. We need to insist that the UN is a word that describes many things, political bodies, operational bodies. We know that UN agencies are doing a great deal of important work in Gaza or in Ukraine or in Sudan, and that's what we must sustain. The political system of multilateralism is that we need to protect and we need to transform. That begins with the Security Council. Amnesty International support the notion of an extended participation to the Security Council, but we are insisting that the veto must be addressed, the right of the veto must be addressed. It is paralyzed at the moment. It is unable to deliver what should have been expected in the case of Gaza because of the veto power, as it is unable to deliver on other crises such as in Ukraine. So the political bodies that are at the heart of what was created in 1948, including the Security Council, are unable to perform their role. Why? Because the member states are making it so. Because they intend on destroying what is left of the multilateral system. So what I'm hoping for is that, you know, we need to continue because we are there. We have the majority of states in the world that want to protect the multilateral system. You have one state in particular, the United States, that is doing everything in their power to destroy it because it is not serving the U.S. interest. But time and time again over the last 2 years, the international community has said we need a multilateral system. We need laws that bind us together. We need rules. Extraordinarily, the Hague group that has been formed to put pressure on the international community's action on Gaza, the Hague groups has also demanded that the International Criminal Court be protected. And there are governments in this group that are no friends of the International Criminal Court, by the way. So everyone is suddenly realizing, wait a minute, we are going to destroy something that at least has protected us from the worst. This is what has been happening for the last 2 years. This is a litmus test for humanity. This is why we're saying, please, humanity must win. And that also includes protecting a little bit of what has been there for the last 8 years and transforming what is not working. International financial institutions need an in-depth reform, which were actually put forward and adopted a year ago during the General Assembly with the Contract for the Future.
Well, I mean, you know, Amnesty is just one of, you mentioned this international, the multilateral system, the international legal framework under which this genocide is occurring. There have been so many reports, findings, decisions concluding that a genocide is occurring in Gaza by many of precisely these institutions, including most recently this UN inquiry, also judicial bodies, the International Court of Justice, the ICC, human rights organizations, Amnesty, which became the first in December, academic organizations, the International Association of Genocide Scholars, humanitarian organizations, medical organizations, Médecins Sans Frontières. Now, we speak to people in Gaza regularly. It's absolutely beyond reason that none of these statements, which they mention, all of these decisions come out, organizations, very powerful ones, make statements. And yet it's going to be next month, it's going to be 2 years that this has been happening. And as you mentioned, these international organizations were born in the wake of the worst genocide in history, or at least in modern history. And they were, you know, responsible for ensuring nothing like this would happen again. Now, of course, it did in Rwanda and Srebrenica and in Cambodia. But in this case, as against all those others, the most powerful countries who were responsible for setting up these institutions are actually backing this genocide, on top of which, as the Irish lawyer who was advising the South African government at the International Court of Justice, as she said, it's the first live-streamed genocide. Yeah. So, you know, if you could comment on that, what is, in fact, the utility of people making these statements beyond symbolic or rhetorical? And second, what is Resolution 377 at the United Nations, and why has it not been invoked in this case, the one, the Uniting for Peace resolution that enables the General Assembly to make a decision when the Security Council is deadlocked, which would, in fact, go so far as to necessitate call for a peacekeeping forces in a situation precisely like this one.
First question. NGOs don't stop genocide. Doctors don't stop genocide. Human rights investigators don't stop genocide. State stop genocide. Companies can stop genocide. The international civil society for the last 24 months, I think, has played its role. The last one being the Commission of Inquiry. The people of Gaza, the Palestinians' human rights organization have played their role. They denounce, we denounce, investigate, report, but we cannot stop the genocide. It's not something that we can, you know, that it's not something that we can do. What we can do is highlight the complicity, is highlight the fact that states are failing to do what they should do under international law, and that too we have done. But when you are, what I think what Gaza is showing us is that when the most powerful state, that is the United States and many states in Europe, are prepared to completely vandalize their own commitment and what they championed 80 years ago, when Russia could not care less because they want to do whatever they want to do in Ukraine, and when China is thinking, oh, this is probably nothing good for me, nothing to gain from it, I won't, then it goes on. It goes on and it goes on. And the 80, 90% of the global community that has repeatedly demanded ceasefire and end to the genocide, we are the global majority. We, not in a racial term, not in an ethnic term, we are the global majority. We have demanded an end to the genocide. States, the majority of states, and yet nothing is happening because the most powerful state starting with the United States, is making it impossible. And that resolution that you are mentioning has been used. The problem with the GA resolution is that they are not binding. But yes, it is remarkable that the General Assembly has, on two or three occasions over the last 2 years, taken upon its own, you know, has grown into saying, well, if the Security Council is paralyzed, we won't be paralyzed. And this is when you realize that it is largely 90%, you know, at the last resolution a week ago, it was on the two-state solution, we had a handful of states voting against it. We are the global majority demanding an end to the genocide. So why isn't it happening? Well, it is not happening because that global majority made up of states is not acting. They know they should do, but are they prepared to do the right thing? Are they prepared to divest from Israelis' company? Are they prepared to sanction those that are feeding the genocide? You know, if 80% of the global community was actually acting on their words, I think the genocide will have stopped. So yes, we are confronting a very powerful enemy of humanity, but sadly, we have not been helped by the fear, by the cowardice, by whatever it is that is currently animating most governments in the Arab world, in Asia, and in Africa. They are not rising to the challenge in terms of actions.
Well, and yes, just, you know, last, you mentioned many European states who are backing Israel. The EU is the largest trading partner of Israel. What would it mean, it's highly unlikely, if this plan to limit trade with Israel were to actually go through, what the EU announced?
I think it may go through, actually. It will have, that's why Netanyahu is talking about creating, an economy, a self-reliant economy. It will have an impact. This is why Amnesty International and others have spent the last 24 months lobbying at the European Union. That has been an absolute shameful 24 months. The president of the EU has made a mockery of any principle upon which the European has been, the European project has been built. It is not just a market project. It is not just an economic project. It is a value-based project, and she has spitted on it for the last 24 months. So we are continuing to demand that the EU act on its founding text. Act on its principles, and there are states in Europe. I have mentioned, of course, Germany, Hungary, as supporting Israel. But let's not forget the role played by Ireland, the role played by Spain, the role played by Belgium. I mean, here at least we have some European states that have spoken loudly and that have acted according to their words.
Agnès Callamard, we have to go, but we're going to do a post-show with you, put it online at democracynow.org, to talk about Ukraine, to talk about Sudan, to talk about Afghanistan and more. Agnès Callamard is the Secretary General of Amnesty International. Coming up, the disappearance of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia. Stay with us. Benfo, Something to Say by the Malian singer Fatoumata Diawara, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the story of Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, an acclaimed Palestinian pediatrician and director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza. As the situation around him became increasingly dire over the course of Israel's bombardment, Dr. Abu Safia began recording videos for the world to see what was happening in northern Gaza and to plead for help. This is Dr. Abu Safia on December 22, 2024.
We do not know why we are being bombed, and we do not know why we are being targeted in this way. Despite us asking the world for international protection, we continue to appeal to the world and remind them that there are Geneva Conventions that the world sings praises of. This includes the protection of the healthcare system and the protection of hospital staff. Up until this moment, unfortunately, we are being targeted in full view of the entire world, but unfortunately falling on deaf ears.
When Dr. Abu Safia recorded that video, the Kamal Adwan Hospital was the last functioning hospital in the north of Gaza. Just days later, Israeli forces stormed the medical complex, and the doctor was detained and imprisoned. He remains in Ofer prison to this day without charge or trial. A powerful new film produced by the documentary program Fault Lines on Al Jazeera English tells his story. The film is called The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safia. We'll be joined by the film's director and a colleague in just a few minutes, but first to the film itself.
They detained him and a few other doctors in the outpatient clinic. They interrogated them.
He was beaten three times in the chest with the butt of a soldier's gun, and by hand, too. He was insulted. He was interrogated about trivial things. Why won't you leave the hospital? Why are you staying in the north?
The situation is catastrophic in every sense of the word.
They told him, Dr. Hussam, don't connect with journalists. They didn't want him to tell the world what was happening in Gaza and in the north.
In the early morning, when the army withdrew from Kamal Adwan Hospital, my father went to check on the hospital and the martyrs. He found my brother Ibrahim among the martyrs.
He collapsed. He was crying for 6 or 7 hours. He didn't stop because he was very, very close to his son Ibrahim.
In the next clip, we hear from Dr. Abu Safia, his wife Albina, and again from his son, who we just heard from, Elias.
They burned our hearts over the hospital. They burned them completely. They killed my son. Because we deliver a humanitarian message.
He was a young man, only 20 years old. He had his whole life ahead of him. He wanted to study medicine and become a doctor like his father. We buried my son next to the hospital, just outside the hospital, and said goodbye to him.
During the burial, my father was called to the ICU and he responded. He left my brother Ibrahim during the funeral. He couldn't even take the time to grieve my brother Ibrahim. He took his tears with him into the operating room. This made him more determined because my father treated all his patients like they were his sons.
The second raid on the Kamal Adwan Hospital occurred on December 27, 2024. In the following clip, nurses Rawiya Tanbura and Abdul Munaim Al-Shrafi describe what happened. We also hear from Dr. Abu Safiya's wife, Albina, describing his arrest and Israeli military personnel issuing orders.
The tanks began to encircle the hospital.
There were so many tanks and vehicles. Me and the guys were joking that they moved all of Israel to us.
Everyone in the hospital, the army surrounds you. You are surrounded.
A big tank entered and stood by reception, and it started firing forward, firing and turning. And then they pointed the muzzle through the reception door, and it was going like this at patients.
I thought it was the last day of my life.
When the army arrived with a tank and a quadcopter, they called him.
Doctor, lift your shirt, doctor. Lift your shirt.
He was going to them confident that he had not done anything wrong. He went to them in his white coat.
Come, doctor. Come, doctor. Good morning. How are you? Everything good? Come on in.
The army ordered Dr. Hassan to get all the people out.
You must follow instructions and gather in the central courtyard. Everyone in the hospital. The army surrounds you.
Dr. Hassan got them out under the army's order, under threat.
In the next clip, Kamal Adwan nurse Rawiya Tanbura describes how they were forced to evacuate the hospital. Then we hear from nurse Abdul Munaim Al-Shrafi about how male medical staff, including Dr. Abu Safiya, were treated by the Israeli military.
They evacuated us women, including the female medical staff.
Of course, every time the Israeli soldier speaks to us, he's yelling, "Wait here, you son of a." We followed his orders and stood without a word. We're scared.
We asked them, "What about the men?" They said, "You're going to go and they'll join you after."
There's no one left inside?
No, there's no one left.
The entire hospital?
Yes, the entire hospital.
Since the start of the raid, we suspected Dr. Hussam would be arrested because they had already threatened him.
The army finished what they needed to do, and Dr. Hussam said goodbye to them. As Dr. Hussam was walking away, they called for him, "Hussam, Hussam, come. Tel Aviv wants you." They blindfolded him. They also tied his hands. And then they made him walk. And then they threw him to the ground and started beating him. That happened to all of us. They were treating us like we're terrorists. Their message was, "We are in control of everyone." They kept us in handcuffs. They humiliated and hit us. They covered our faces and told us to walk like this. They removed our clothes. We stayed in our underwear. We were walking in a straight line behind each other. Dr. Hussam at the start, and the medical staff behind him. I could see Dr. Hussam, but I pretended I couldn't see him because I didn't want him to feel deflated. I didn't want to see him like this.
Now to a final clip from the disappearance of Dr. Abu Safiya, including his wife Albina and his attorney Reid Qassem. It begins with footage from Israel's Channel 13, where Dr. Abu Safiya was seen for the first time since his imprisonment.
Sufyan, how are you? You are a doctor of Kamal Adwan, right?
Yes.
Everything that a detainee eats per day does not exceed 1,000 calories.
His weight was around 90 to 95 kilograms. His lawyer told us that he now weighs 60 kilograms. What did they do to him for him to get to this point?
There's a deliberate policy inside prisons to starve people there. They want to make an example out of them. I don't know if the prison administration deals with the detainees like they're truly human beings.
You have seen the hostages, our hostages, Israeli hostages.
What is he saying?
Did you see the Israeli hostages?
No. My work is mainly with children. I'm a pediatrician.
They interrogated the doctor a lot.
Most of the questions that they asked Dr. Hussam in the interrogation were about his work at Kamal Adwan and about the hostages and fighters.
After all the beating, all the torture, and all the interrogation, they still weren't able to pin anything on him.
Even when the intelligence services come to talk to him sometimes, they say, "We have nothing on you, but despite this, you are being held, detained, and we're still interrogating you."
Why are you here?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Excerpts from Al Jazeera's Fault Lines documentary, The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safiya. We go right now to Amel Guttatfi, who is the director of this film. We only have a few minutes. If you can talk about last time the doctor was seen, head of the Kamal Adwan Hospital, particularly known for its care for children, and how it's possible that he has been held without charge, without trial, and what you know of his whereabouts now and his condition.
Yeah, of course. Dr. Abu Safiya now is in Awfar prison. That is a prison in occupied West Bank. According to Bistislam there, there's clearly a policy of torture and beating and abuse at the prison there. He's been held for over 250 days without formal charges and without any due trial. The only person that's been able to visit him is his lawyer, and that's because she's fighting very hard to get those visitations. He has really awful conditions that have been documented by multiple organizations that show you that there is an organized and declared policy of the prison authorities to treat the 2,600 detainees that are inside these prisons poorly.
Well, Dr. Azra Ziada, you were in touch with Dr. Abu Safiya every day for months. Your final thoughts, both on the film as well as on his condition now?
So I think the film really exposes and captures the process and the blueprint that Israel uses to attack and decommission hospitals. And I think the film is the most pertinent at this moment in time, because this blueprint is being used right now across Gaza. However, it's not really under the limelight, and it's not as exposed as it was when Dr. Abu Safiya was in Kamal Adwan.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Dr. Azra Ziada, we thank you so much. London-based medical doctor, healthcare systems analyst, who's helped gather evidence of war crimes from Gaza and has been in touch with a network of doctors and healthcare workers in Gaza, including Dr. Abu Safiya. And thank you so much to Amel Guttatfi, who is the director of this documentary, The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safiya, which is available online. We'll link to the whole documentary. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Nicole Salazar. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Hi, my name is Taku. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CGSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Everyone should be treated equally, and the legal system should work for the people, not against them.
Every day, our network of supporters, lawyers, and educators from across the country continue to fight against injustice and oppression, both in and outside of the courtroom and at all levels of government.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
CJSA